Okay, so it's my really great pleasure to introduce my friend and sort of former colleague, former co-author, Elizabeth Sheehy, who is a professor of law at the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law. And one thing to mention about that is from 2002 to 2005, she held the Shirley Greenberg Professorship in Women in the Legal Profession and organized many important workshops and events in that capacity. Her teaching subjects include criminal law and procedure, women and the law, advanced torts, and women in the legal profession. And I think it's very fair to say that Liz is internationally recognized for her feminist work on criminal law and violence against women, especially sexual assault law and criminal law defenses, such as self-defense, which she'll be speaking about today. As well, what's particularly remarkable about Professor Sheehy is that she has, throughout her career, donated her legal expertise to many social justice causes, including litigation, for example, cases such as the Bonnie Mooney case and the Jane Doe case, which you may know of, as well as to legislative reform. In 2005, she was awarded an honorary doctorate by the Law Society of Upper Canada for her feminist activism in furtherance of women's equality in law. And as I mentioned before, I've had the pleasure of co-authoring with Professor Sheehy in the past, and I can speak to her intelligence, her integrity, and her great sense of humor, which just make her a pleasure to work with. In addition to her many published articles, she's edited numerous books, most recently Sexual Assault Law, Practice and Activism in a Post-Jane Doe Era, which is in press with the University of Ottawa Press, so that one is something to watch out for in the near future. Of most interest to us today, she's currently editing a book entitled Battered Women Who Kill, Analyzing Legal Outcomes, and this book is based largely on the analysis of trial transcripts, and Liz will be talking a bit more about that when we finally let her talk. So the structure of this afternoon is that Liz is going to speak to us for probably about 40 minutes, and then we are going to have two comments on the chapter on which this talk is based. And those comments are going to be done by two of my colleagues, who I'm going to briefly, more briefly than I have just done, introduce to you now. The first is going to be Professor Emma Cunliffe, who will be well known to students, of course, at UBC Law, having won the Killam Prize for Teaching Excellence in just her second year of teaching, which was last year. Dr. Cunliffe's research focuses on expert evidence in homicide trials, particularly expert medical evidence, and her book, Murder, Medicine, and Motherhood, great alliteration there, will be published with Hart later this year, and it looks at child homicide prosecutions in the early 21st century. This research, like that of Professor Sheehy's, is based in part on a detailed examination of trial transcripts, and so that's one reason we've asked Emma to comment on Liz's talk today. I'm next going to introduce my colleague, Professor Darlene Johnson. Professor Johnson has taught previously at both the University of Ottawa, also a former colleague of Professor Sheehy's, and the University of Toronto before she came to join us at UBC Law about 3 years ago. And in between her first two teaching posts, she coordinated the successful land claims research and litigation for her community, the Chippewas of Miwash First Nation. And in 2008, she was awarded the designation of Indigenous Peoples Council from the Indigenous Bar Association of Canada. Her teaching interests include Indigenous legal traditions, Canadian Aboriginal and treaty rights, and law and colonialism. But I think it might be fair to say her passion is really legal history. And her current research focuses on the relationship between totemic identity, territoriality, and governance. And she, too, has a forthcoming book coming out with UBC Press. I believe its tentative title is Litigating Identity, but that might be a work in progress as well. So without further ado, I'd like to invite Professor Sheehy to speak to us. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you for that incredible introduction. It's far too much. And thank you all for being here on a Friday afternoon. I really can't believe this many people are here. It's really an honor. Thank you very much. I'll try to do my best to live up to the audience. I'd like to start, you can see my title, Not a Battered Woman, Jamie Gladue. I see this is going to be a challenge for me. There we go.
Great.
Am I going to have to keep more eyes? Oh, okay. I'll have to look over there. I want to dedicate this talk to our former colleague, friend, and generous spirit, Dr. Patricia Montour, who died this past November. I wish to recognize her magnificent contributions to the dignity, freedom, and equality of Aboriginal peoples, women, and especially Aboriginal women serving prison sentences, really the subject of my talk. Hours of her 19th birthday in September 1995, outside a townhouse complex in Nanaimo, BC, Jamie Tanis Gladue was heard shouting, "I got you, you effing bastard," while jumping up and down as if she had tagged someone. That someone was Reuben Beaver, her 20-year-old common law partner. He'd been tagged in the heart with a large knife and died pretty much on the spot. She was charged with second-degree murder, but in light of the evidence that he had apparently had intercourse with her sister Tyra about an hour before, and when confronted had called her fat and ugly, the Crown prosecutor accepted a guilty plea to manslaughter on the basis of provocation. She was sentenced to 3 years in a federal penitentiary in February 1997, and that sentence is somewhat longer than the average for women who kill abusive spouses, which in Canada is about 2 years less a day, or conditional imprisonment, also known as house arrest. She went on to make legal history in 1999 when her sentence was appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. As you know, hers was the first case in which the court interpreted the 1995 criminal code provisions that required judges to consider all available sanctions other than imprisonment, particularly in the cases of Aboriginal offenders. Ironically, while hailed as a victory for Aboriginal people, the Gladue ruling simultaneously denied Jamie Gladue herself the benefit of that ruling because her crime, manslaughter, was violent. In spite of the notoriety of her precedent-setting case, little is known about the facts in Jamie Gladue's, the facts behind her conviction. And even less is known about her personal history beyond the fact that her mother was Cree and her father Métis. It's partly because she pled guilty after her preliminary inquiry, which means only one version, the prosecutor's, has been publicly aired. But it's actually worse than that. Even though manslaughter is a very serious crime, and in this case, the BC Court of Appeal called it a near murder, and Jamie was the mother of two young children and was 5 months pregnant with her third, no one ordered a pre-sentence report so that her history and prospects for rehabilitation could be carefully considered. One might be forgiven for wondering whether sentencing a young Aboriginal woman for a violent crime was considered routine, such that individualized justice was superfluous. Also disturbing is the fact that appeal judges resolutely refused to correct the omissions on appeal. When her second lawyer attempted to introduce a psychologist report that described her experience of battering by Reuben Beaver and its impact on her on the night she killed him, the BC Court of Appeal said it was too late, this was fresh evidence that should have been brought forward by her trial lawyer. In any event, the judge knew of Reuben's conviction for assaulting Jamie when she was pregnant with her first child, but the judge had concluded that she was not a battered wife. Furthermore, the appeal court said, the doctor's report contains statements that suggested that Jamie had acted in self-defense in conflict with the position taken at sentencing. Jamie was not entitled to introduce a new explanation unless she was prepared to repudiate her guilty plea. On further appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, the court did not comment on the critical yet excluded evidence that Jamie was a battered woman. They held that in principle, the sentencing judge should have been offered a pre-sentence report containing information regarding the individual and systemic background information about Jamie as an Aboriginal person and available alternatives to her imprisonment. However, since Jamie had already been paroled and her offense was categorized as most serious one implicating domestic violence by Jamie, no injustice had been done. Was Jamie Gladue's outcome just? Did she have equal access to a fair trial where she could have placed before the jury the full context of her acts and received the benefit of a judicial instruction that would have related the context to the law. Thank you, Darlene. These are the questions that frame my research project, in which I'm investigating the cases of battered women who've killed abusive partners in the 15-year period since La Vallée was decided by the Supreme Court of Canada in 1990. La Vallée is, of course, widely recognized for shifting the law of self-defense from its masculine premises to account for women's lives by affirming the admissibility of battered woman syndrome evidence in support of self-defense and by jettisoning the imminence requirement such that battered women need not wait for the uplifted knife. But by the time that Jamie Gladue pled guilty, it seemed that only a handful of women had received the benefit of La Vallée and been acquitted. The most salient effect of the case, it appeared, was to facilitate plea bargains for manslaughter. Although compassionate sentences often followed, this looks like mercy, not justice, and not even mercy for Jamie Gladue. My research project used news services and legal databases to identify the cases of battered women who killed their male partners so that I could identify and then purchase transcripts from preliminary inquiries, sentencing hearings, and trials when possible. For the first time, trial transcripts have been opened so that the evidence and the legal strategies advanced can be assessed against the promise of the law of self-defense, the news coverage of these cases, and what we know about women's lived experience of intimate partner violence. Thank you. This slide shows an overview of the 107 files that I found. I've excluded the ones that did not raise self-defense. So there's about 20 files up there that I removed from my sample because other defenses were in fact raised. And then I excluded another number of files where the prosecutions were either stayed or dismissed, often on the basis of self-defense, but I couldn't get much information because prosecutors do not have to explain those decisions. Yeah, the next one, thanks. These represent the files in which self-defense was at play in one way or another, and you can see that more than half of these ended in a guilty plea. Of those women who went on to a trial on the merits, approximately 50% were acquitted, another 50% were convicted, mostly of manslaughter, but there were a couple of murder convictions. And here you see my more specific data on Aboriginal women as they appear in my files. And you will see here that they are disproportionately represented among the 107 files as a group, but the disproportion increases as we narrow to the files that involve self-defense, and it further increases when we look at their overrepresentation among the guilty pleas. So I had 44 guilty pleas, 26 of those were Aboriginal women. It's astonishing, it's probably 60% of the guilty pleas were by Aboriginal women. As a white feminist scholar holding race privilege, I need to acknowledge with humility that I possess only a fraction of the knowledge needed to do justice to Aboriginal women's lives and their encounters with the criminal justice system. And yet, with the little knowledge I have from this work, I feel I have a huge responsibility. Aboriginal women are such a substantial proportion of the women in my research that their experiences can be seen as paradigmatic in many ways. In my book manuscript, I discuss the historical and current practices of colonization that create and sustain Aboriginal women's acute vulnerability to male violence. But for today's talk, I'm limiting myself to the more specific barriers for Aboriginal women charged with homicide. The rate at which Aboriginal women plead guilty to homicide and enter prison in this country is devastating for them, for their children, for their communities, and for our larger society. Keeping Aboriginal women out of jail, I think, is an urgent priority, and I hope that this work can contribute to that decolonizing objective. Although all battered women on trial face serious barriers to a fair trial on the merits, Aboriginal women's unique context poses additional challenges, and Jamie Gladue faced many, although not all of these. Aboriginal women are highly overrepresented among women convicted and sentenced for violence. While they might constitute around 3% of the population, they're at least 30% of federally sentenced women and at least 50% of those classified as maximum security, i.e., seen to be dangerous. They are thus far more likely to have criminal records that make testifying in their own defense very risky, particularly if they have records for offenses of violence. Women's use of alcohol, drugs, and their experience of addictions are well-known consequences of violent abuse. Addictions may impair women's memory of the critical events leading to the homicide and may also affect their ability to testify credibly. And I have many files like this, in fact. But Aboriginal women are susceptible to stereotypes about their substance abuse in addition to any real impacts of addictions. Linguistic conventions also affect how Aboriginal women's accounts are understood. They describe assaults in terms suggestive of mutual combat, using phrases like, he was fighting me, we were fighting. Jamie, too, used this phrasing, we fight and I hit him, but I would never kill him. Racism is another subtle influence in credibility contests that Aboriginal women face. How can lawyers make juries aware of the importance of that racism without provoking a backlash against the accused? Aboriginal women are often viewed as active and feisty, which may be inconsistent with the generalizations that are usually associated with battered woman's syndrome. They may not look like good mothers or good women, you know, in terms of the framing of battered woman syndrome, and they may have had multiple short relationships as opposed to, say, a 25-year relationship that looks like entraps a woman more than short relationships might. But I think the most significant challenge is that Aboriginal women are invariably described as the aggressors. Over and over, witnesses, prosecutors, and judges state emphatically that the Aboriginal accused is not a battered woman, or not a real battered woman, whatever that means. And obviously, Jamie Gladue faced this particular barrier. These barriers in turn induce more Aboriginal women to plead guilty. The report of the self-defense review by Her Honor Judge Lynn Ratushny in 1998 commented on the incredible pressures put on battered women to plead guilty to manslaughter, caused in part by the mandatory life sentence for murder, which is more oppressive for women who have small children, you know, facing the possibility of a life sentence, the uncertainty in the law of self-defense, and the psychological aftermath of battering. These pressures are intensified for Aboriginal women, of course. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, for example, stated that it appears that Aboriginal people have little understanding of their legal rights, of court procedures, or of resources such as legal aid. And most enter guilty pleas because they do not really understand the concept of legal guilt and innocence, or because they are fearful of exercising their rights. Aboriginal women's experience of colonization and racism may lead them to accept responsibility for the homicide, regardless of the facts, to atone to the family of the deceased, or to make peace in their communities. Lawyer-client communication can also lead to ill-advised guilty pleas. One federal government report noted that, in some cases, as a result of the difficulties in cross-cultural communication, the extent and quality of communication between the accused and counsel may be limited to the point where the accused is underrepresented. I'd say that's a very polite way of putting it. And yet, self-defense looms on the horizon of every Aboriginal woman's homicide, making it critical that lawyers defend these women vigorously. They face 8 times the risk of intimate partner homicide. All the women in my files had experienced intimate partner violence, consistent with what we know about the stats on Aboriginal women's experience of intimate partner violence. All of the women killed in the context of an altercation, unlike the files for non-Aboriginal women, where some of those women killed men who were asleep, passed out, unconscious for other reasons. None of these Aboriginal women killed someone who was passed out or asleep. They all killed in an altercation. And they were also more likely to have corroboration from family, neighbors, community, and even police. Contrary to expectations, Aboriginal women, in fact, are more likely to contact police, in keeping, perhaps, with the more severe levels of violence and more debilitating effects that they experience. Consider, for example, the case of Donelda Kay. This is an artist's drawing. She was charged with second-degree murder for having stabbed Dennis Noel Gordon once in the heart, causing his death. She was tried by a jury of 7 men and 5 women in a trial presided over by Mr. Justice Jean Maurice in the Saskatchewan Queen's Bench, June 94 in Regina. Had Donelda not been defended by Don Worm, a lawyer who understood well the colonial history and current dynamics that enable male violence against Aboriginal women, she too probably would have pled guilty. Don Worm was 4 years old when he witnessed the murder of his sister and his mother by his sister's ex-husband in their home in Saskatoon in January 1964. He managed to stay calm and quiet through a terrifying drama in which his older brother was also struck unconscious with a knife and lay on the floor while his 3-year-old cousin hid crying under a table. His brother survived, but Don Worm carried the burden of being the Crown's chief witness, making him one of the youngest eyewitnesses to testify in a murder trial in Saskatchewan. He was raised by his parents on Poor Man's Indian Reserve in central Saskatchewan. A member of the Kuakatoos First Nation, Don attended law school at the age of 21, graduated, and was called to the Saskatchewan Bar in 1986. By the time he was approached by Donelda's community to represent her, he'd established himself as a young criminal defense lawyer. It seems that Donelda's community held a great deal of sway with Don Worm, for she too came from Poor Man's Reserve. Ms. B.L. Ducta's opening address indicated that the case against Donelda Kay was open and shut. She had been part of a group that was socializing in apartment 2 in a Winnipeg building on September 25th, 1993. She'd had an argument with her partner Dennis that had become escalated during the evening. The jury would hear that a 15-year-old who had retreated from the party to apartment 3 across the hall saw Donelda run at Dennis with a knife and stab him. The Crown's first witnesses were 3 police constables. They described the premises, Dennis's body, the scratches and abrasions on Donelda, and the forensic evidence found in apartment 2. Don Worm attempted to plant the seeds of reasonable doubt. Under cross-examination, the officers acknowledged that they had failed to photograph blood stains in the hallway, did not examine the stairway outside the apartments for evidence. They acknowledged that the view from apartment 3 into apartment 2 was partially obstructed, and that the hand of the deceased bore swelling consistent with having punched someone and was taped, as might be a boxer's hand. Rebecca Bourassa was the only witness to the stabbing. The source of the argument was that Dennis had given away Donelda's clothing, some of it to Becky. Becky testified that it was Donelda who did all the yelling, swearing, and slapping. Donelda grabbed a knife from Becky's apartment floor, waved it and challenged Dennis, and then ran directly at him across the hall from apartment 3 into apartment 2, stabbing Dennis while he sat in a chair. Worm began by trying to insert Donelda's story into his cross-examination. With prompting, Becky recalled that yes, Donelda had asked her to go to the other apartment and tell Dennis that she was leaving, which Becky had done. Donelda went down the stairs, but when Becky looked out her door, Dennis and Donelda were back arguing outside her door. Worm pursued doggedly what this witness did not see that night, forcing her to admit that she'd missed certain details and events. Beyond casting doubt on her capacity to observe, he questioned her credibility. He dealt on her many statements to police and to the media that she was the only eyewitness to the stabbing, suggesting that she got a lot of attention out of this. He also exposed her criminal record for theft. Through this witness, Worm introduced a theme he would return to. He asked Becky whether she was concerned about the escalating argument between Dennis and Donelda. Becky replied that it was none of my business. The Crown brought forward other witnesses who'd been drinking in apartment 2. Darcy Longman said he saw Donelda punch Dennis in the head and push him, causing him to fall into a wall. Worm's first question of this witness cut to the chase. He asked whether the relationship between the two was violent, to which Darcy responded, yeah. Worm drew from him an incident that he had witnessed. Donelda had broken a beer bottle over Dennis's head, who then picked her up by the neck, throttled her into unconsciousness, dragged her body into another room, dumped it there while they then went out drinking. Worm asked Darcy whether he'd spoken to Dennis about this. His answer? not my business. Just before we let this witness go, Worm asked, you and your girlfriend sometimes get into that kind of fight or argument, don't you? Yeah, was the last word from Darcy Longman. The Crown's last three witnesses were the police officers who arrested and questioned Inelda. Sergeant John Cavers testified that her first story was that she came to apartment 3, found him with a knife in his stomach and didn't know who did it. She was confronted with the witness statements, so then she admitted the argument and the stabbing, but she told the police that the deceased had been assaulting her. He kept kicking me in the stomach, he'd broken my ribs before, he had this knife, he said, stab me, just do it. He was beating me up, I told him I was gonna call the cops, I was walking downstairs, but he pulled me up by my hair and made me sit on the couch. Can you change the slide? Pressed, Danelda agreed to yet another more inculpatory version, and you can see the version here. He says, actually what happened, Danelda, is you got really angry. You took the knife, and maybe he did tell you to stab him, but you took the knife first, isn't that correct? She says, yes, I did. And then he says, you were really angry about your clothes, weren't you? She says she wasn't angry about her clothes, but she does admit that she was mad. She says, I was mad about what he was doing to me. Dawn turned the cross-examination of each police officer to the subject of wife assault in a deliberate attempt to reposition Danelda as a victim, not an aggressor, and to educate the jury about the dynamics of wife assault. So he got the arresting officers to testify to the gendered nature of wife assault. He got them to admit that women are often beaten half to death, that women recant or lie about their injuries, that women often do not report it. He also even got them to give an explanation of battered woman syndrome. So I thought that was pretty amazing. Here's the police officers for the Crown testifying about battered woman syndrome. Sergeant Cavers admitted that why battered women stay with their abusers was a complete mystery to him, however. Worm attempted to mitigate the effect of Danelda's initial denials and her late disclosure of abuse. He proposed that only as Danelda became more trusting was she able to admit that she committed the offense. Cavers agreed, and so Worm continued, and she reported to you at that point that she was the victim of such abuse, did she not? Yes, admitted Cavers. Don Worm's opening address told jurors that he would call a number of doctors, not simply to go through every injury that she sustained, not to call evidence of every traumatic beating that she received, but just to go through a representative sample so that they could understand her statements to the police. Like Sergeant Cavers, he told the jury, they too might wonder, why did she stay? Worm told them that he would be calling psychologists to answer this question so that they could avoid engaging in myth-making. Worm's first witness, Randy Pipko, described Dennis and Danelda's relationship as abusive. One night, he and Darcy called on Dennis. They asked where Danelda was. Dennis raised his fist and said, I put her out for the night. Randy explained, I gathered he knocked her out. Was he concerned about Danelda, Worm asked. Randy replied, maybe a little, but it was none of my business. Don Worm then produced an expert who was familiar with Aboriginal women's experiences of what Sharon McIver and Teresa Nahaney call the cycle of terror. Dr. Josie Catania was qualified as an expert in children at risk and their teen mothers. The overwhelming majority of her Regina clients were Aboriginal women. Danelda had entered counseling with her in 1992. She divulged that she'd experienced maternal neglect and abuse. She was assaulted as a child by her uncle, then as an adolescent, and again by multiple male partners as a young adult. Danelda Kay was thus a survivor of what Dr. Catania called multiple serialized battering. She testified that a person exposed to multiple abuse and violence by different men would experience more serious and more debilitating effects. She explained if there are more persons, more than one person abusing, each abuse constitutes a confirmation or reinforcement of your value as a person. At this, Justice Maurice interjected his first of many warnings to the jury. Dr. Catania had provided a great deal of hearsay evidence about Danelda's life that was of no value unless those facts were proven before them. Kim Eklund, a worker at a battered women's shelter, testified that Danelda had sought refuge with her children in the summer of 1993. She was badly physically abused on her whole face. She had bruises all over her. Danelda's sisters testified about several incidents where Danelda asked for help after Dennis had beaten her. Her sister Shellen described a particularly chilling night in September when Danelda was dropped off at her door by police. She said that she felt sick in her stomach because she was like I could barely recognize her. Danelda's face was swollen, her lips were cut, she was coughing up blood. She had bruises and welts across her back and legs. She was moaning in pain. She could not open her mouth wide enough to drink anything. The next day, Shellen helped her make her way to the doctor, but it took three times as long to get there because Danelda could barely limp along, and she held her head in her hands the entire way. Dennis Gordon found them and caught up with them and got Danelda up against a wall and threatened her that if she didn't go with him, something else is going to happen. Danelda's family doctor, Dr. Varma, also testified that she presented with multiple injuries September 1st, 1993. She'd been beaten with a belt, kicked in the head, jaw, and neck by her boyfriend's boots. She had bruises all over her face, neck, chest, and legs, and a fractured nose. Dr. Varma saw her again September 24th, which was the day before the homicide. She had severe chest pain and was spitting up blood. An X-ray was booked to investigate whether her ribs were fractured. Dr. Kevin Schlemp, an emergency physician at Regina General Hospital, examined Danelda after her arrest. He found her depressed and silent. She had scratches and abrasions and tenderness on her stomach and back caused by severe trauma to her back. Don Worm laid before the jury the full range of possible acts by Dennis. Would it be consistent with being caused by a physical beating, kicking, hitting with other instruments, other objects, being thrown against something? Yes, was Schlamp's answer to each proposition. Dr. John Richardson testified next as to Danelda's blood alcohol levels, which put her at close to twice the legal limit. Meanwhile, Dennis's blood revealed at the time of his death he'd consumed more than twice the legal limit and a drug that compounds the effects of alcohol, such that someone with a history of behavior consistent with going through on threats would go ahead and do it. Don Worm's most important witness, however, was Dr. Patricia Nielsen, who is the best expert that I've seen in any transcript I've read. She worked as a psychologist with male batterers, and unlike most experts, she did not focus on whether Danelda had a syndrome or whether she suffered from learned helplessness or whether she mistakenly perceived herself to be trapped. Instead, she trained the jury's focus on Dennis Gordon's violence. She described the normalization of violence in Danelda's life, and that's my first quote here. If you grow up when you're surrounded by violence, when every person you know is violent, and every relationship you've ever been in is violent, then your acceptance of violence increases, she said. She was interrupted by the judge, who issued his second warning to the jury that Dr. Nielsen was speaking based on what she'd been told by Danelda and her family. They should give no weight to opinions based on matters unproven in court. But Dr. Nielsen continued, scrupulously avoiding pathologizing Danelda as having a tragic background or experiencing personal failure. She said, if you want to predict empirically which relationships are going to be violent, you have to look at the characteristics of the man. She continued, there's potential for any woman to be a victim of abuse. She called Danelda's the worst case of abuse she'd seen in 10 years. She described horrific attacks by Dennis on Danelda's body, including an occasion where he kicked her with boots, beat her till she bled, sexually assaulted her, and then tied her up. He then assaulted her spirit as well by bringing his friends over to look at her in that condition and laugh. "This is my old lady," he said. Justice Maurice interrupted the witness and gave his third warning, seemingly getting even more angry. "You can't give any weight to any part of an opinion that's based on statements like that, where there's no proof whatsoever before us of that." Don Worm closed with this witness by asking whether Danelda had reason to fear for her life that night. The Crown's objection came too late, for Dr. Nielsen quickly replied, "Oh, definitely. She tells me she was afraid for her life and thought she would die that evening. But even if I didn't know that from her mouth, just knowing the history, I'd predict she would be dead by now." Change it. Crown Attorney Dutka secured a significant advantage, however, in cross-examination when she established that Danelda's relationship with Dennis was a very short duration, possibly as short as 4 to 6 weeks, taking it well outside any of the literature or studies on battered woman syndrome. Ms. Duk has attempts to get Dr. Nielsen to acknowledge that Dinelda's accounts may have been fabricated failed miserably, however. Instead, Dr. Nielsen used every question to launch into a further explanation for the jury about a wife battery, basically. She discredited the notion that there are always two sides to a story. Although people usually think that the truth is somewhere in the middle, she said this allowance should not apply to wife assault. She said, my experience is that if he says this and she says that, the truth is somewhere more extreme. Battered women invariably minimize the violence as a coping strategy. She testified that the phenomenon of mutually combative relationships had been panned in the scientific literature. And as for the suggestion that Dinelda might have killed out of anger, not fear that night, Nielsen insisted that context is everything. And there's another quote here. Actually, it should be the next slide, sorry. Battering creates a whole atmosphere, a whole kind of surrounding environment of fear and control. And then it's within that that whatever happens. So it's not like you feel afraid today, but then the battering stops so you don't fear for your life. The fear is pervasive. Dutka persisted, asking Nielsen to suppose a woman who acted aggressively to a partner all night, egging him on and physically assaulting him. Isn't it possible that such a person is not acting out of fear? Dr. Nielsen remained skeptical. I would find it hard to believe that a battered woman who'd been that beaten would be able to act like that. But, she offered, I suppose it's possible. Don Wurm declined to re-examine this witness, but before he closed for the defense, he asked to adjourn for the remainder of the day to take instructions. He had a really difficult decision as to whether to call Dinelda to the stand. He must have worried about her ability to testify about what she'd experienced without detaching emotionally. Rupert Ross, a Crown prosecutor on Ontario's North, says that Aboriginal witnesses often describe traumatic events in a flat, emotionless fashion that can be interpreted by non-Aboriginal judges and jurors as lacking in credibility. Dinelda's initial denials and her contradictory confession would make her a vulnerable witness. The transcript of her police interview revealed a pattern of gratuitous concurrence. Her willingness to agree with various propositions advanced must have been a real concern for her lawyer. She was also very young. She was steeped in remorse, and the abuse she experienced may have rendered her a defensive witness. It's not uncommon for women who've experienced terrible violence to internalize it as something they deserved. Dinelda would have been easily provoked if the Crown were to bait her with blame. On the other hand, as you know, self-defense is a difficult defense. It requires some evidence to show that the woman was unlawfully assaulted that night and to show that she actually and reasonably feared death or grievous bodily harm and that she actually and reasonably could not otherwise have preserved herself. These are difficult elements to show without her testimony. Don Wurm returned on the morning of June 15th to announce that the case for the defense was complete and he was ready to make his jury address. Dinelda would not testify. Addressing the jury, Wurm said, we trust you to use your common sense. Dinelda trusts you. He focused on reasonable doubt, pointing out the gaps in the police collection of evidence and in Becky's testimony. Becky had not seen Dennis pull Dinelda back up the stairs by the hair. She did not see him assault or taunt Dinelda in the hall outside her door. Wurm put stock in Dinelda's statements to police that Dennis wouldn't let her leave and that he was beating her. Dennis's swollen hand, his drug and alcohol readings, and Dinelda's injuries corroborated her account, he said. Wurm reviewed the testimony of the doctors and her sisters who had seen her injuries in August and September. Is there any question who did this to her? He asked rhetorically. He told the jury that historically men were entitled to use force to chastise their wives as an aspect of women's status as chattel. He said to the jury, I hope you've changed that attitude. Women, the same as men. They don't have to run away if someone continues to beat them up. Recalling the evidence of Randy Pipko, who had said Dennis put Dinelda out for the night, he said, that's not the way I kiss my wife goodnight. He reminded the jury that no one was going to help Dinelda. It was none of their business. He asked them to focus on Dr. Nielsen's evidence that Dinelda had experienced the worst abuse he'd ever seen, and that knowing her history, she predicted she would be dead had Dinelda not acted. In contrast, the prosecutor's summation emphasized the reliability of her chief witness's evidence. Becky was one of the few people who wasn't drinking that night at the party.
She said that Donelda's statement to the police only turned to self-defense once her version was contradicted and once police asked her if she needed the knife to defend herself. Dutker argued that little weight should be given to Dr. Nielsen's opinion because no one gave evidence about the duration of the relationship or the frequency and severity of the abuse. Donelda surely would have reported to police if the horrific abuse alleged had been true. She urged the jury to reject self-defense. Donelda was not fearful. An acquittal, she warned, would be allowing her to commit murder in circumstances of revenge and anger. Maybe I'll say very little about the jury instructions. The judge gave his fourth warning to the jury about the dangers of relying on the hearsay and the expert testimony. He gave instructions on provocation, intoxication, and self-defense, framing it in Lavallee's terms. But he also warned the jury that they should not conclude that the deceased should have been killed. They can't use their negative feelings towards the deceased as a basis for acquitting Donelda. The jury began deliberating that same day, June 16th. The next day, they returned several times to the courtroom with questions. Could previous assaults justify self-defense? The judge explained an assault need not be imminent to justify self-defensive violence. He was then asked to explain once again the meaning of manslaughter and the phrase beyond a reasonable doubt. The judge obliged and the jury again retired. They were called in by the judge that evening, June 17th, for what's called an exhortation. Justice Maurice urged them to find a unanimous verdict so as to avoid the cost and waste of a mistrial. On the other hand, he said, if they could not reconcile their verdicts, then they will have done the best they could do. They continued deliberating on June 18th, but by noon on that day, the judge again called them in for another exhortation, saying that another jury will not be in any better position to bring in a verdict than you are. Instead, they returned with yet another question. Could Donelda use self-defense if she'd provoked Dennis that night? Justice Maurice instructed them that self-defense was available whether or not she had provoked Dennis, and they retired once more. 10 minutes later, at 4:30 p.m. on a Saturday night, the jury returned with the verdict. Change it. The foreman pronounced the decision not guilty. The clerk of the court asked, not guilty of anything? The foreman confirmed. The judge then repeated, perhaps incredulously, just so I'm positive, Mr. Foreman, your verdict is not guilty of anything? Again, the answer was confirmed. Justice Maurice persisted and asked for the third time, not guilty of murder and not guilty of the included offense of manslaughter? The foreman's answer was curt, correct. The jury had been out for 3 days, which was then the longest jury deliberation in Saskatchewan history. Justice Maurice commended them on their conscientious approach to the task, but Dutka was not satisfied. She requested then that the jurors be polled individually. The judge acquiesced, ordering each juror to affirm their not guilty verdict in open court one by one. Only then was Donelda Kay released from the prisoner's box. She reportedly closed her eyes and appeared dazed. Her mother let out a moan and began to sob. To reporters, Donelda said she was very happy about the verdict and smiled shyly. My last slide. Was Jamie Gladue well advised to plead guilty to manslaughter and forgo her right to trial? There are striking similarities between her case and Donelda Kay's, as well as threads of evidence that may have supported self-defense in a trial on the merits. Both women were extremely young. Donelda was 21, Jamie was 19. They both had small children, Jamie was pregnant, and actually, Donelda and her doctor both thought she was too. Both had been assaulted on previous occasions by the men they killed, and both had injuries cataloged by police on their arrest. Both homicides took place after extended drinking parties, and both women were described by witnesses as the aggressor in the confrontation. The chief witness for the prosecution in both cases claimed to have witnessed the accused stab the deceased seemingly intentionally and in the absence of any sort of physical conflict. While in Gladue, the witness was a white male neighbor, in the Kay case, the young witness had been part of the evening's events. Despite the differences in the age, sex, and origin of these two key witnesses, the cases must have appeared to be straightforward prosecutions. That confidence that they were easy could only have been enhanced by the fact that neither woman's police statement was internally consistent or externally consistent with other witness accounts. and neither statement was entirely exculpatory. Yet in some ways, Jamie Gladue should have had a better chance at acquittal than Denelda. No one saw Jamie assault Reuben until the fatal and final stabbing. Jamie had been in a common law relationship with Reuben for almost 3 years, making battered woman syndrome an easier fit. And since Reuben had been convicted of assaulting her while she was pregnant, this likely was only the tip of the iceberg in terms of his violence. Further, Jamie had been assessed by an expert as actually experiencing battered woman syndrome, which surely would have buttressed self-defense had they gone to trial. The transcript from the preliminary inquiry reveals additional evidence that strengthened Jamie's case over Denelda's. One witness, Georgette Atleo, testified that after the party, she saw Jamie trying to push Reuben away while Reuben was grabbing onto her. Jamie was yelling that he should leave her alone. Furthermore, unlike Becky, who denied hearing any sort of fight between Dennis and Denelda before the stabbing, the chief witness in Jamie's prosecution heard a loud physical fight before Jamie and Reuben emerged from the townhouse. He heard a female voice swearing, but also loud banging, a physical struggle, and the sounds of furniture being slammed about. At the sentencing hearing, the Crown introduced photographs showing the bruising on Jamie, and he acknowledged that Reuben may have been threatening Jamie and her fetus that night. However, the prosecutor said even accepting the assault inside the premises, once Mr. Beaver left the home, there was no longer any threat to the accused or the fetus. It also becomes clear from the preliminary inquiry that Jamie was not simply jealous of the relationship or of Reuben's behavior towards her sister, Tara. Tara testified that she left the party because she'd had too much to drink. At home, she'd vomited, gone to bed, and then woken up to see Reuben peering at her through her bedroom window. He then entered her apartment through the kitchen window and approached her in her bed and began kissing her. She rejected him at first, but then kissed him back. However, she testified, when he took off her pants and his and tried to have intercourse with her, she pushed him away. Seconds later, they heard Jamie banging at the door. He jumped up, dressed, and left. Only then did Tara begin crying. She testified that she'd been crying because it brought back bad memories. She said that the bad memories related to being taken advantage of or abused, and that Reuben had followed her only because she'd been drunk. Consider what a lawyer who was more knowledgeable about wife battering and Aboriginal women's realities would have done with Jamie's statements to the police, her injuries, the evidence about the confrontation in the townhouse, the other available information about Reuben Beaver, and experts like Dr. Catania and Dr. Nielsen. We will never know for certain whether Jamie Gladue or the other 25 Aboriginal women who pled guilty would have been acquitted had they gone on to trial. But Denelda Kay's acquittal against all the odds surely suggests that Jamie Gladue was underrepresented at best. Passionate and strategic lawyering by counsel knowledgeable about Aboriginal women's lives and able to see beyond the stereotypes and to insist that the law of self-defense as articulated in Lavallée also and especially must inure to the benefit of Aboriginal women is an urgent priority for all of us committed to justice for battered women. Thank you.
Begin by thanking Liz for taking on this work. It's, as you can imagine, terribly difficult work, and it's complicated for her, I'm sure, as for many non-Aboriginal people who want to try to accomplish some type of justice within the Canadian legal system, of what role is there for people who actually are from outside the Aboriginal experience. And so this is very hard work to do, but it's actually really, really crucial work, and it needs to be done. I also want to thank her for paying a tribute to Trish Montour, Trish and I started teaching in the same year. We taught together for a few years at the University of Ottawa. I think one of the most difficult things for people who want to do good in the face of horrific violence that is undeniably connected to the experience, ongoing experience of colonialism in Canada, is how to gain access and how to ensure that you do no harm, which is one of the messages I keep delivering to students who were working with me in Law 200, that you need to know what the odds are, you need to know what the barriers are, you need to know what the stereotypes are, and how is it that you do no harm. And I suppose that one of the challenges for defense counsel is if you don't take a guilty plea to manslaughter, the results could be worse, and you can't discount that. But if you know going in, if you choose to do this type of work, that there are these huge barriers, and not the least of which are problems with intercultural communication. If you don't understand what tends to be, I think, a fairly general Aboriginal response to harm and violence, which is fatalism, you won't know how to interpret some of the responses that you get from your clients. If you don't understand their life experience, if the Crown says not a battered woman, well, would it help if you said how about an abused child? How about an abused teenager? How about an abused? You can't just start with the person in front of you once they've been arrested after the killing. And so one of the challenges then is, how do you acquire that understanding? How do you know the questions to ask? How do you, if you yourself aren't a racist, or at least consciously racist or conscious of your stereotypes, how do you anticipate the stereotypes that the Crown is dealing potentially with, that the judge might have, that the witnesses might have, that the police might have? And so it's a really, I think, daunting task to even think that as a non-Aboriginal person, and possibly as a person who has not suffered intimate violent abuse that's intergenerational, where do you start? And I think the starting point has to be, and one of the students in my Law 200 class articulated this, she said she one time went and spoke to a group, and there were Aboriginal women there, about getting involved in the political system, and a woman, an Aboriginal woman, came up to her later, and she said, "You don't even know what you don't know." Right? And you don't even know what you don't know. But if you're committed to freeing battered women and to ending the cycle of violence and abuse, you have an obligation to find out what you don't know. And I think law schools have an obligation to help teach you what you don't know. And I think we as a society have an obligation to put more money into legal aid. I remember, I actually know Don Worm, and the world needs more Don Worms. I did the third year of my law degree at the University of Saskatchewan, and I remember a defense counsel coming in to speak to us during our bar course. Very, very popular, charismatic, successful defense lawyer. And the first thing he said to us was, "How much justice can your client afford?" Because he said, often the most you can do for a person charged with a indictable offense, you can probably only afford the preliminary inquiry. And so we see in Gladue's case, right? She lost at the prelim, plead her out. And there's only been more and more and more cuts to legal aid. And if there's not funding to do the work that needs to be done, and if there aren't enough defense lawyers, and if there aren't some kind of, I don't know that you can do mandatory cross-cultural training for Crown attorneys, let alone judges, But all we can do going forward as educators and you as students is you have to find out what you don't know and try to do no harm. Thank you.
So the question of finding out what you don't know is a really great place to pick up in a sense, because I think that the importance of Liz's work and the power of Liz's work is its capacity to bring forward the stories that we don't otherwise hear. And as Darlene says, it's incredibly difficult work to do, incredibly emotional work to do. It's a hard chapter to read, and it's been a hard chapter to listen to today, I know. But first thing that I'd like to do is say thank you, Liz, for the work, because it's an enormous contribution. And I think I see my role here really as being a sort of a transition to, I think we'll have a few minutes to questions, and so I'll keep my comments very brief. The two chapters, the chapters to objectives, are set out very clearly by Liz, I think, at the start of her talk, and it's kind of worth reminding you of them. And those are, first of all, to demonstrate the things that differentiate Aboriginal women's homicides from those that we may be more used to hearing about. And to demonstrate also the ways in which there are enormous and troubling parallels between the lives of Aboriginal women who come before the criminal justice system in this capacity. The second is to highlight the pressure to plead, which Darlene explained some of the reasons for, bears even more heavily, it seems, on Aboriginal women than it does on others. And so Liz has shown us that more than half plead guilty to homicide charges, and that this is more than half of all of the guilty pleas that she saw in her sample, and those are terrifying numbers. And yet, of the 12 women who went to trial in Liz's sample, 8 were acquitted. And that does suggest that there are good reasons to argue these cases all the way through. And so the need for good legal representation is clearly a key theme of Liz's work. It's the thing that made the difference when Don Worm represented Donelda Kay. His capacity to understand her story, perhaps even more significantly to translate it into terms that the jury could hear and understand, to ask the right questions of police officers and of Crown witnesses, and to have the courage to ask those questions. I think a question that haunts the chapter is how we might understand the violence that is done to Aboriginal women, but also the violence that is done by Aboriginal women in a way that is more nuanced. The chapter sets up many of the harms of colonialism, the ways in which the impacts of those harms is gendered. It notes that some Aboriginal women, and Gladys Heavenfire, who's another battered woman case that wasn't discussed in today's talk but is described in the chapter, managed to turn their lives around after escaping relationships of violence and after escaping the criminal justice system. It also alludes to some of the ways in which violence against Aboriginal people is not taken sufficiently seriously by state authorities or by others within society. And so contextualising Aboriginal women's violence in these and other ways is crucial, I think, to getting a clearer understanding of this violence. But difficult questions remain. How might the exercise of prosecutorial discretion account for the harms of colonialism but still protect Aboriginal women and children from the effects of violence? Are there other ways to take violence more seriously than simply by adopting stiffer charging practices, which seems to be the default response? What about the material factors of poverty, of poor quality housing, that are arguably implicated in the heightened violence of Aboriginal people's lives? And I think these are questions that run through the book, and as Darlene says, that one of the challenges is to understand not just the moment that leads to the homicide, that leads a woman to court, but all of the things that precede that moment in her life. And so this, I think, is a good moment to invite people to ask any questions they might have at Liz. And again, say thank you very much. It's a fabulous chapter.
So we've got just over 20 minutes for questions. I see questions already. I'm just going to move the phone out in front and speak up.
Well, maybe Isabel has a question.
And yes. And Isabel, if you have questions too, please jump into the queue. So when you have a question, please introduce yourself and speak up so that Isabel can hear. Maybe Liz,
you might be the one to call them.
Might take 3 or 4 questions at once, and then you can respond to the bunch of them. And then given that I think there's going to be lots of questions and not so much time. So we'll start with that.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I have a kind of practical question. question. I've been working at the UBC Criminal Law Clinic this semester, which has been a great experience. Many of the clients we have are Aboriginal people. And so one of the strategies we have tried to do is introduce what I guess are called the new factors now. And even on less serious matters like a shoplifting or assault, that even if our clients are pleading guilty, that we feel that there are important things to be putting in the sentencing and the submission. And what I'm finding is that it's more of a laundry list of things. And the response sometimes from the court is, well, that's a sad story, but I've heard much worse, and it doesn't seem to, I don't know how, my sense is that it's not being taken into account as much as I hope. These personal issues of this client would be taken into account. I'm just wondering if you can comment on that and how you see a way to sort of bring a little bit more weight to those.
You know, I honestly don't have answers to that. I suppose, I'm sure you do frame what you're arguing in legal terms and in glad-do terms, right? So the judges know that you're not just putting a story in there, you're making a legal submission based on directions from the Supreme Court of Canada, right? So you're doing all that. I'm not sure what else you can do except for be clear that it's on the record for the purposes of appeal. I don't know. I don't know if other people, do other people have comments on how you would respond?
I can comment a little bit. My name is Sarah Ratch, I'm the director of the UBC First Nations Group. And we just, the other day, had a judge challenge one of our students during the field between.
Can you speak up?
Yeah, sorry. We just, the other day, had one of the judges challenge our students when she was doing a guilty plea on what did she mean by referring to Section 718.2 of the Criminal Code on a small summary conviction. And what we do is we frame it within a context of the sentencing principles. But the comment from the judge at the provincial court level was, you can't just say it, us judges don't know what to do with it. You need to tell us how we should consider this Aboriginal person and why. And so we quickly put together a legal argument that satisfied her. But it is a live issue that judges don't always know what to do, and there's a certain amount of backlash where they'll say we've been doing that all along, and so it's a good point that you raise. It's not an issue.
But I'm assuming you have a legal argument and you are framing for them this principle means that this factor should go to mitigation or to the type of sentencing disposition.
And it kind of picks up on what Emma was saying, that it's these small incidents that set up sort of a pattern of behavior for these clients or this.
Well, what it sets them up with is criminal records.
Yes.
If they're women, then mean they're in real trouble if they kill husbands or male partners, because they've already now got a criminal record for assault or whatever, for their violent offenses. It's really important to fight those small ones, because the accumulated record then makes them really vulnerable to being pled out, you know, if and when they end up in a much more serious situation. I don't know, do you use media here? Do you use media here?
Media?
Yeah. Like, what I mean is, it would be an interesting story for a journalist that, look, you know, we've got all this great law and look what happens. Judges just give it the flick. I don't know. I don't know. You'd have to think about that.
There's a question in the front here.
Hi. My name is Cindy Allen. I'm a Welideyon Asteni Kito person. I'm just wondering if you actually, in the course of your research, actually talked to any of the Aboriginal women, or you just looked at the transcripts and looked at that, or did you actually talk to the Aboriginal women?
I haven't talked to any of the women in any of my files, because it would be, it's another whole process of getting ethics approval. And I've contemplated doing it through Kim Pate, because Kim Pate, if some of you must know her, she's executive director for the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, and she's telling me she could talk to the women and feed the information back to me. I'm not sure if that would satisfy her ethics board. I'm not sure. But she is certainly one of the people who says it's absolutely critical that we stop Aboriginal women from pleading guilty, that we try to at least get in there and talk to their lawyers and find out what they've got. I mean, obviously, Jamie Gladusler didn't even know what the evidence was at the time he pled her guilty. Didn't even know what the evidence was. But so no, I haven't talked directly to Aboriginal women. I've talked to sometimes to their lawyers, and I've talked to people like Kim who work with them. But I don't actually have the right to just call any of the women in my files. I really want to.
My name is Pamela Shields. I work for Legal Aid. I'm the Aboriginal Services Program Manager for Legal Aid. And I've started a program at GLADU Initiative, which is on the ground writing GLADU reports. It's not a PSR, because I don't think PSRs do any good for the clients. There's a GLADU component in there that the corrections officer gets information from Google. We train Aboriginal advocates around the province to write these reports. And they talk about the community, where that person is from, the history of the community, his family history, and how that person, him or her, got to this place in court.
I think the lawyers need that before they make a decision on whether they're going to plead guilty.
They absolutely do need that. They need as much information as possible. And we've been doing it ad hoc. It's going to be part of the tariff system as of today, where a lawyer can request a GLADU report as an expert report, just like they request a psych report.
Before they make a decision on pleading guilty.
I'm hoping that they do that, yes.
Yeah. Because that would really help, right? For a lawyer to see, okay, here's the people who know something about what's happened to this woman, or here's my witnesses, and here's her family history, here's her life history. Now I'm going to go find the expert that can help me work with this, to support a self-defense argument.
But there's a lot of backlash. There's a lot of backlash from the Crown that's happening now. In fact, there's I'm right in the middle of hearing sentencing on April 8th. If anyone is interested, the judge had new case law. He heard from defense and Crown, and she gave them two new case laws and said, prepare submissions and come back. Prepare submissions on these two cases. One was really pro-GLADU, one was anti-GLADU. And she said, come back. I want to hear submissions on this, and her judgment will be on the 8th at Main Street. And the Crown is just, they're just so adamant against the GLADU factors. They think it's a get out of jail card for me, and that's not what it is.
Well, does any of that, those GLADU reports talk about, are they gendered? Do they talk about women's experience of violence? And
absolutely. And my
because the Supreme Court gave nothing.
No.
By way of guidance or relevance or credence to those issues, but
the number of women in jail is just it's just tragic, and it means more kids in care, and it's just a continuation of the cycle.
Yeah.
And the women aren't accessing these GLADU reports as much as men do. And then the courts say, well, why should, if they're two Aboriginal, if there's an Aboriginal victim and an Aboriginal defendant, the court is saying, well, why should they get off? Why should this Aboriginal victim have less protection because they're Aboriginal? And that's part of the backlash. But we need to start here in law school. I didn't know about GLADU until I was at the clinic. So we need to start talking, like, have a whole class on GLADU.
Anything else?
Other questions? Isabel, did you want to jump in by phone?
Yeah, I guess, Liz, I wanted to ask you about sort of the role of mandatory minimum sentencing in all of this, because it seems to me that, taking a case to trial is a huge, huge gamble, no matter how good the representation and how good the expert evidence. And I wondered, and the Supreme Court of Canada seems really reluctant to second guess any mandatory minimum sentences now. And I just wondered if there's any room for some kind of argument using GLADU to attack mandatory minimums that way.
Could you just repeat the question, please?
Yeah, well, she's saying, no matter how good your lawyer is, you've still got a huge risk for a woman who wants to go into trial when you're facing a life sentence if, you fail. And in fact, even if you fail with respect to manslaughter, I guess you all know that the manslaughter mandatory minimum is 5 years now, if a firearm is used. That's not usually how Aboriginal women's homicides pan out, but they are how other women's homicides pan out. So there's even a mandatory minimum for manslaughter in certain circumstances. So she's asking, you know, is there any sort of charter argument or challenge that we can make to those mandatory sentences using GLAAD-DO? And I certainly think for Aboriginal women, you've got a good argument. I don't know about other women. I know that Larry's worked a little bit on this, and he certainly, Larry Chartrand I'm speaking of, he certainly made submissions before this Senate Standing Committee last fall about the new mandatory minimums they were proposing, and I think he persuaded them that they had to remove them for Aboriginal people. So, I mean, I think that would be important if we could even get the mandatory minimum sentence for Aboriginal people removed as unconstitutional or as in conflict with the other provisions in the code. I'd say it's the area of greatest need is Aboriginal women. I think you could really justify saying there at least that's worth getting, you know.
Mm-hmm. Question in the front here. Can you say something about the patent advantages that women are suffering prior to the events? So typically, as you can see, they've been victims of criminal abuse repeatedly.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been trying, and I don't know the work's been done in Canada about the way in which police are training and police intervention, but it strikes me that all the things I completely agree with what you said about where my next sort of focus attention, but also this question about police training is actually indicating that the early interventions are taking complaints seriously, that treating domestic violence is seriously, rather than something that's resolved in the parties or messy police work or generates paperwork or any other number of narratives that usually use a downplay. So this notion of course. But also the best scenario is, of course, if women are removed from the abuse situation, you don't get to these positions. I often worry that the police aren't getting the training they require, they're not. So I just wanted to say something about the histories that lead up to, and these sort of patterns of violence that lead up to these tragic events.
So I think, I mean, one of the books that's important to this chapter is a book by Anne McGilvray and Brenda Kamaski called Black Eyes All of the Time. And she did a study of 26 Aboriginal women who experienced intimate partner assault. And they basically came up with a composite picture of the Aboriginal woman who had experienced intimate partner assault. And she talks about the fact that among those 26 women, they had been assaulted or perpetrated against by hundreds of perpetrators. 26 women, hundreds of perpetrators, thousands of assaults. So, you know, where do you start? I'm not sure what you're asking me.
I guess I'm wondering whether it should be part of mandatory parts of police training that actually expose that literature. Actually, early in the training, there's heaps of research on that police are acculturating into the stereotype, and that was very early.
Well, police are terrible on white assault, period.
Yeah,
and then when you come to Aboriginal women.
Yeah. So an interest of me is how you, I mean, there's a whole selection mm-hmm. question of who applies to become a police officer and how that. But there's also a lot of research that you go to states to say that early year, that first year of training, you can do a lot of work in China in terms of providing a defense against the stereotypes that they get bombarded with as they do the work. So
right.
I wonder, often one would actually make it a mandatory part of police training to actually have to read this literature, actually have to be exposed, actually have to have a. And they're very resistant, but they're hugely unhappy about when you make those
yeah.
suggestions. But I actually feel quite strongly that they should be exposed to that literature. And I take your point about law school. Everyone in criminal justice system actually has to be conscientized.
Yeah.
I think judges should get mandatory training in this link. Police officers get mandatory training. It has to be a cost to all of it. Because actually, when you look at the inputs of race and sentencing and all manner of other criminal justice, it's the slow drip. It's happening at every point. Right?
Well,
and you're
quite right. Police response increases Aboriginal women's vulnerability
yeah.
to further violence.
And
increases their hopelessness as to whether anything is going to be done or can be done. So there's no question police are part of it. Training, I don't know.
It's hard.
Yeah.
So,
I was wondering, just about these cases and the space, because I'm interested in the idea of space and where systemic racism happens. I think Shereen Razat talks about space, gender. So are these cases that you looked at more specifically, rural spaces or like more poorer spaces or like city centers like Vancouver?
Mm-hmm. I've got my chart somewhere here, but I would say they're both rural and cities. I certainly have cases where people couldn't reach the RCMP detachment. You know, they called 5 times and no one's answering the phone or no one's coming. That's how rurally they're living, you know, that they have to call the detachment that nobody answers the phone at. So, I mean, there's one case, I think it's Denise Rain. I think he might have died maybe before they finally got there. They took them over an hour. But even in Danelle DeKay's case, that apartment was right across the street from the hospital, and it took like 20 minutes. And the people testified, no, that's Gladue. Gladue? I think it's Gladue. They testified that they could have walked him over there faster than waiting for emergency services. So even in cities, Aboriginal people's emergencies don't necessarily get immediate or professional responses.
My other job, I'm a criminal defense practitioner, and I am representing a woman who has a potential battered woman's defense. And I just wondered if you could comment on in your research at the preliminary hearing stage, because of course that's a judge alone, as opposed to going to a jury, and then you know there's the choice that women need to make about electing jury or judge alone. If you could comment on the sense of a jury as community judging when a woman makes contacts, as opposed to judge alone, if you had any insight into whether it would be beneficial here, I'll ask you for advice for my client to
get to the jury.
Have a judge alone or a jury, and also to waive her right to a prelim, because I know that you've researched the transcripts of the prelim and how that's used in terms of that really low threshold of whether there's a tribal issue. But if you could comment on that, just a judge.
Well, you know, one of the themes of my book is that I firmly believe that if juries get access to the whole story, you know, where we haven't had all the evidence ruled out as irrelevant in voir dire or too prejudicial in voir dire, that if the jury of your peers, a woman's peers, hears the story, I think she'll get acquitted. That's my experience. When lawyers are good lawyers or judges have been generous in allowing the jury to hear the whole story, I think juries are really remarkably appreciative and able to get the bind that women are in, and the fact that there are no safe options. You know, there's nothing a woman can do that will guarantee that she will survive, except for killing. There's no other way that you can be sure that that guy is not going to come back and kill you or your children or your mom. And I think juries understand that if they're given access. And so, you know, it's always going to be a fight with a judge about what evidence will or will not be permitted. But I think I have a lot of faith in juries. I really do. But I do think also jury selection is important. And sometimes you can tell who you really don't want. Have I answered your question?
Yeah, but I was just wondering at the preliminary hearing stage, does the defense get made out there often, or do you have?
I don't know. I see some defense lawyers. I have one file in which the preliminary inquiry, the Crown's witnesses, introduce the whole defense, and the Crown still goes ahead, first degree murder, all the way. Didn't stop the Crown. So I don't think many cases get stopped at the prelim by the judge. Like hardly anybody. I maybe have 2 cases where a judge dismissed it after a prelim. But most of the cases get sent on.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so I think if you go to prelim, she'll be going on to trial. But you'll have an opportunity maybe to get more information. But I wouldn't bother putting any of your witnesses on.
or cross-examining the complainant. In my case, he's still alive. It's
still alive. Oh, yeah, you might want to cross-examine him. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of cases that my friends have looked at in New Zealand that have been a successful acquittal where the guy lives. And that's because when the guy gets on the stand, he is such a wanker. What he's saying is so implausible and so obviously dishonest and so manipulative that he's just, like, absolutely discredited, and jurors, you know, acquit the women. So you might hope for that. That he might be a really poor witness in his own, as to his own victimization.
So we have one more question here, short question, short answer.
Well, I was just wondering, why do you think, like, the average lawyer is so bad at predicting the outcome of the trial? I mean, you have this big discrepancy between so many guilty pleas and then so many acquittals, right? Like, the proportions seem way off. So what is it, do you think, that makes that the way it is?
Well, I, when it comes to the Aboriginal women's cases, I think it's not that these lawyers are so prescient that they've managed to pick the winners. I think that these are cases where they work their tails off. Don Wyrm turned over every stone, every stone. He let nothing go by. You know, he did everything. He took some risks. I mean, here he is arguing battered woman syndrome for a woman who's been in a relationship for 4 weeks. It's like really nervy. But he went and got the expert evidence and reshaped it to fit Aboriginal women's experiences. So I think that, I mean, he also made a decision, which is a risky one, to not put her on the stand. But remember, LaVallée didn't testify either. It's kind of a negative message coming out of that, eh? Women are most credible when they don't say a word. I don't know. I've worried about that a little bit. How come those cases, you know, they stand out for me as... cases that won, but the woman didn't testify. So I don't think, I suspect that Don Wyrm had no idea if she was going to be acquitted. All the way through, I'm sure he didn't know. Seemed to me that the judge thought she was going to be acquitted. I think the judge was quite shocked that, you know, she didn't get manslaughter. He started rushing them on their verdict quite early. He was quite worried that they were not going to get to a verdict early. So I think the judge thought it would be manslaughter. I'm sure people like Don Wyrm, their heart's in their throat the whole time. They have no idea.
Doug has allowed me to do the honors of thanking people today. And first of all, I want to thank everyone who came, as has been said before, at the end of a long week, in a very long month. Well, I guess we're in a new month, but anyway. So thanks for your attentiveness to this incredibly important subject. A very serious one, clearly one that many of you in the room are engaged with, which is a really interesting thing to, I think, add to all of our knowledge. One, I really thank Darlene and Emma for their very thoughtful comments. And Liz, yes, you can clap them first. And for our special speaker for the day, Liz Sheehy, I have a very small little token, which is actually, is there anyone here from the Women's Caucus? Chance? Student Women's Caucus? No. Well, that's too bad.